Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident. This is the 132nd episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'll be talking about something that is really high yield for the USMLEs. This is something that will be very helpful on step 2 CK and step 3. And really, I'm going to be focusing today. It's almost like a grab bag. In fact, I'm kind of struggling with a name for this podcast. But the focus is just going to be on weird topics. So weird topics that people usually see on the USMLEs. And they're like, this is not in a mainstream resource that I may have studied. I've sort of decided to like mentally collate many of these things and sort of talk you through them, right? And the thing is, most of these weird topics are focused on the social sciences. So things like patient safety, social sciences, population health, end of life care, power of attorney, like just those little things here and there. They're not things that you can, again, necessarily find covered like in a comprehensive text. But they're just little things here and there that, you know, like kind of like my risk factors podcast, where I, again, try to catalog a lot of like risk factors, put everything in one spot. That's what I'm going to try to attempt to do here. I'm going to try to put all these high yield things in one spot, and where possible, I'll present them as like case scenarios, but I will just sort of like, it's almost going to be like freestyle. It's going to kind of seem all over the place. But again, I promise you, this stuff is super, super, super high yield for exams. And I will try to be as quick as possible. But this will be again, I promise you, if this podcast will be well worth your while if you sort of take notes and sort of keep things at the back of your mind. Okay, so what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, they have like lung cancer, it's terminal, they're in hospice, and they're not really eating? What kinds of medications can you prescribe for those people? Well, the thing is, you can give them a megestrol acetate. It's one of those progestin analogs. You can also give like some derivatives, or like some cannabinoid or derivatives like dronabinol. You can even give steroids. These things can all spruce up that patient's appetite. So if a patient has like really bad cachexia from cancer, you can spruce up the appetite by giving these drugs. Although the thing is, these drugs do not like make them live longer or reduce morbidity or anything like that. But they spruce up those people's appetites. And then, what if you get a question about a patient? Again, this is like a terminal patient, lung cancer. They're not doing well. They're in hospice. They're about to die, sort of deal. And the person is like super depressed, right? Like they're like becoming like hopeless. They feel guilty. You know, like the classic CG cap signs of depression. What kind of pharmacologic therapy would you want to explore in those people? The thing is, you should actually consider, because the classic thing you may be thinking is, oh, let me use an SSRI. No. An SSRI is not what you would want to consider for depression in the hospice setting. You want to think more about like stuff that's used to treat ADHD, like methylphenidate, for example. I mean, if the person is like super anxious, you can consider like a benzo, okay? But methylphenidate in general is what you want to consider choosing for people that are depressed and are like in hospice, like people that have like weeks to live, sort of deal. And then, what if they describe a person that has some kind of malignancy, lung cancer, brain cancer, whatever, and they have like really bad like shortness of breath, so like dyspnea? How do you want to treat those people? Right, you'll actually want to go ahead and give those people opioids like morphine, okay? Like morphine, opioids are actually like standard of care for that patient population. And then, what if they give, and real quick, you want to keep in mind that these people that are placed on opioids, right, you need to place them on a bowel regimen, right? Because remember, opioids can cause constipation. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, is on chemotherapy or like radiotherapy, and or they have like really bad cancer and they have like a ton of nausea and vomiting? How do you want to treat those people? You'd want to give them a serotonin receptor antagonist, right? Like ondansetron, right? Basically, the drugs that end in cetron, Remember, this is just like a different factoid, but remember that those drugs have the ability to prolong the QT interval. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, they have like terminal, like glioblastoma, for example, they have like days or like few weeks to live, and they've been feeling super nauseous, and they have like increased ICP. How may you pharmacologically help that nausea in that setting of increased ICP? I would hope you're thinking about steroids, right? Like you can give prednisone, dexamethasone, basically glucocorticoids can help under those circumstances. Now, what if you get a question about, what if you get a question about a patient that has neuropathic pain on your MBME? So you get a question about a patient, you know, they have like, you know, like burning, tingling in the extremities. What kind of pain regimen would you want to consider for those people? Well, I hope you're saying things like you essentially they're like psych style medications, right? So you'd want to use stuff like your TCAs, right? And remember your TCAs all end in triptyline, right? Like TCAs, you can also try some SNRIs like duloxetine, for example, is a popular one on exams. Or you can use things like gabapentin, pregabalin, stuff like that. So those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that has like cancer pain and they have a history of depression that has been treated for a long time, and then they tell you that this person was placed on a pain medication, and then this person all of a sudden started, like days later, started having like myoclonus and they had like fevers and stuff like that. What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about serotonin syndrome and tramadol. Right? Remember, tramadol can trigger serotonin syndrome, right? It's a serotonergic agent. So in general, tramadol is usually the wrong answer on MBMEs for like cancer pain because it's not very strong for pain. And it also has like a ton of interactions. And then, what if you get a question about a patient that has like cancer that is like widely metastatic to like the kidneys, to the liver and all that stuff, and then this person is having like severe pain, what kind of opioid would you want to consider under those circumstances? I would hope you're thinking about like fentanyl, right? Fentanyl, it's pretty safe, especially in people that have like kidney disease or liver disease kind of deal. The other opioids, for the most part, you want to be careful if a person has like liver failure or kidney failure, right? So say, for example, morphine. Morphine is something you should not use in like liver injury or like kidney failure. There are like super specific requirements here. But most of the other opioids like hydrocodone, oxycodone and all that stuff, if a person has liver failure, you want to be like super, super careful when starting those drugs. So at the very least, like lower the dose that you're going along with. And then one common scenario that the MBMEs love to throw on exams is they can give you a question about a person that has like really bad like cancer pain. And they tell you that, oh, that like at their last visit, their morphine dose or whatever was increased. And then they tell you that they come in tears, they're still complaining of pain and all that stuff. And they ask for the next step in management. For those people, go ahead and give them more opioids, okay? They will try to trick you by telling you that, oh, maybe screen the person for drug abuse or whatever. If a person is terminal, end of life, you give them as much pain control as they need, okay? Again, within reason, right? But in general, the right answer on MBMEs will be to increase the dose, right? Or increase the frequency of their opioid regimen. And again, very high yield to remember. If a person is on an opioid regimen, they may give you a next best step in management question where the right thing to do, believe it or not, is to actually go ahead and give them like a bowel prep, okay? So things like Docusate, you can give things like these osmotic agents like a lactulose, sorbitol, PEG, all that stuff, right? Those can help under those circumstances. And then, what if you get a question about a patient, you know, end of life care, they have like a cancer pain. Is there a particular drug you want to avoid? They occasionally throw this on MBM is to mess with people's heads. I would encourage you to never pick meperidine ever as an answer choice on an MBME because meperidine can cause like seizures. So it's usually not the right thing to do. There are very few situations where meperidine is ever correct, and I don't see that within the realm of the USMLEs. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then one classic scenario you may see on an MBME exam, right? If a person, let's assume you get a question about like a physician, you know, that comes in, you have the smell of alcohol under his breath and all that stuff, and then they ask for your next step in management, right? Your next step will be you want to go ahead and, you know, mention it to like people in charge, right? Like either like a chief of staff or like the medical board or like an ethics committee at like the hospital or something, right? But you want to report it to some kind of a higher authority. And what is the difference? So let me, I guess I'll frame this as a scenario. So if a person is still being treated with like, oh, you know what, we have this intent to cure this cancer, can that person still go into palliative? Can that person still be placed under palliative care? I would hope you're saying yes to that. The thing is, palliative care actually does not preclude you from getting like therapy that may cure like a certain malignant, like a certain disease, or may prolong the person's life. Okay, palliative care, believe it or not, has actually been shown to improve outcomes in patients, right? So you don't need to be like, oh, this person is about to die to get palliative care. No, if a person is severely ill, you can actually go ahead and, even if it's not a severe illness, but in general, it's severe illness patients that go under palliative care. You going under palliative care does not mean that, oh, we're sending you off to die or anything like that. No. You want to try or make sure on your exams to be able to differentiate that from like hospice care, where you're essentially caring for a patient in the last 6 months of life. So those are things that are high yield to know for exams. And then another question you may see on your test may relate to like a medical error, right? So let's assume they give you a question about like an error that was made, patient was harmed. And then they ask for the next step in management. Some of these things are kind of obvious, but again, they are not things that people think about all the time as they prepare for exams, right? Obviously, if an error has been made, the first thing you want to do is to go ahead and admit it to the patient, right? The thing is, the MBME may even give you like an ethics style question where they say, which of the following is the most likely outcome of admitting this error to a patient, right? The thing is, when you admit errors to a patient, right, the original thinking may be that, oh, I may get sued. The thing is, a lot of the data in general shows that when you admit an error to a patient, the likely outcome is you not getting sued for disclosing that error. Okay, so that can be like a very weird MBME question where you say, oh, which of them is the most likely outcome of so and so, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. You're actually likely to not get sued when you disclose an error. And then this is probably kind of like a touchy topic for me, but I will just sort of make, I guess, like some general statements that are on MBA that you should keep in mind for MBMEs. But essentially, like a physician assisted suicide is not legal. It's illegal in essentially every state in this country. I mean, there are some like gray areas about like where like a person gets a lethal prescription from the physician, but I'm not really gonna talk about that. But just in general, physician assisted like deaths and suicides, they're not legal in this country. Again, it's not black and white like that, but it's not legal in this country in every state on MBMEs. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. And then, what if you get a question about a patient where they tell you that, okay, this patient has like terminal cancer? In fact, they may not necessarily have terminal cancer, but let's assume this patient is like super sick. This patient is in their 60s, 70s. And, you know, there are still some medical therapies that can be considered for them. But a patient says, okay, you know what? That's it. I think I want to sort of hang my shingles here. I'm no longer interested in therapy and all that stuff. And then they ask for the next step in management. You want to go ahead and respect those patient's wishes, right? You don't want to like impose your will as a physician and tell them, oh no, we can save your life by doing this. No. If the patient demonstrates understanding of the situation, they communicate their decision effectively, they understand the risks and benefits of whatever decisions they've made, then you cannot impose or force your will on patients as a physician. Now, the reverse is also the case, right? So if, for example, there's like a therapy that's like futile, like has like essentially the outcomes are not good with that therapy, like you're just like, yeah, trying this therapy is just like a waste of, not, let me not put it this way, let me not say it's a waste of medical resources, but like it's not standard of care, like it's therapy where you know that there's not going to be any effect on this patient's outcome, then under those circumstances, you do not need to, you're not obligated as a physician to participate in those interventions, right? So the classic case may be a person that has like a severe illness and they are likely going to die. And then like a relative rushes in and says, do this, do that, do this, do that. Even if those things are not, they'll tell you something that they read on Google or in the newspaper or something. If it's not medically indicated, you are not obligated as a physician to do any of those things. And then another touchy issue that pops up occasionally on MBMEs is, especially like with OB-GYN questions, they may tell you about like a physician that, you know, has like certain beliefs on things and says, you know what, this intervention is not something I'm comfortable administering. Even if it's something that the patient requests or the patient needs or something that is medically appropriate for the patient, but the physician like says that, you know what, my ethical principles disagree with this. You're actually allowed as a physician to disagree with, if something violates your ethical principles on MBMEs, you're actually allowed as a physician to, you cannot be forced as a physician essentially to administer that kind of care. But the thing you generally have to do is to transfer care of that patient to another physician, okay? They'll be able to administer those services to the patients. Okay. Again, you may see Divine, you're kind of all over the place. These things kind of sound weird, but again, I promise you, these are all things that are very high yield to know for step two CK and for step three especially. And also step one to a limited extent. Now, what if you get a question about, you know, like an old person that like very old, they're kind of senile. They're not taking their medications as they should. They keep getting admitted for things that they should not be admitted for if they were like under the care of someone. What would your next step in management be for those patients? I would hope you're seeing to go ahead and like, you know, like appoint like some kind of like legal like guardian or something. Because those people, they just need people to like make good decisions for them and take good care of them. Okay, because they'll usually make it like a pretty obvious like scenario where this person, if they were under the care of a responsible party, they would not be admitted this often for all these problems. That's like the classic way that presents. So keep that in mind for your exams. And then I've sort of talked about this in my first ethics podcast where I said that, you know, if you're less than 18 years old and you're like still living with your parents or you're like not married or you're not like in the army, the navy or the air force or whatever, then your parents' decisions are the things that essentially stand, right? It's not like if you're under the age of 18 and basically most of your decisions do not count, right? There are certain exceptions though, right? Like for like substance abuse, mental health, reproductive health, kind of deal. And then another thing that classically confuses people on exams is this whole difference between like capacity and competence, right? So capacity and competence. So remember that capacity, right, is something that you can actually determine as a physician. If you're a physician, you can determine if a patient has decision-making capacity. And this is something that is especially important on step three. When a patient communicates a decision to you, if the patient does not have capacity, then that decision they communicate to you does not stand. You should not act on that decision in one of your answer choices, right? So the classic scenarios may be a person that is like under the influence of a substance or a person that is delirious or a person that is altered. When those people communicate a decision, you do not respect those decisions because those people do not have decision-making capacity. And I mean, there are certain key things, right, that tell you that, okay, this person has a decision-making capacity, right? So first thing is, do they understand what's going on, right? You want to make sure they understand what's going on. You want to make sure that they can sort of look at things from like a risk-benefit sort of standpoint, right? Like, oh, they know the risks of like refusing so-and-so therapy. They know the benefits of accepting so-and-so therapy, right? And then like being able, like in clear terms, not like in vague terms, like clear terms, communicate their decision to the provider. Those are all things that tell you, okay, this person has good decision-making capacity. You can go along with whatever decision they make. But competence is not something that you can decipher as a physician. This is something that's best left for the legal system, right? And then the thing is, occasionally you may see MBME questions where they talk about, how do I put it? They may give you a scenario, and then like, how do I put it? It's almost like a person that, so let's say like a person's power of attorney or like a surrogate decision maker. They may give you a scenario of a decision that was made by that surrogate and then ask you that, like, what's the principle that that person followed in coming to that decision, right? So let's say, for example, they give you a question and they say that, oh, you have like a 23-year-old person, you know, they're... they had like an opioid overdose, and they are comatose in the hospital. They're not responsive, and then they call like their next of kin or whatever, and that next of kin says, you know what, let's go ahead and withdraw life support. Let's say the person that is comatose, let's say his name is person A, right? Person A, if he was alive right now, would say that he wouldn't want to be on life support and this and that and this and that. If the surrogate decision maker is making decisions based on what he thinks the person that is like comatose would agree with, if we were with them, then that would be an example of something called a substituted judgment standard. Okay, again, these little terms, you may say divine, this looks low yield. I promise you, if you have experience with the MBMEs and the USMLEs, you'll know that these things I'm talking about are certainly not low yield. So that substituted judgment standard, it's basically what, like, the principle that's being reflected in this person's decision making process. But if, for example, they give you a situation where you're the surrogate decision maker, and let's say you're trying to decide for a person that's comatose, like, okay, let's say there are two different like treatment options available, and the physician has come, spoken to the surrogate decision maker and said, you know what, the data shows that this therapy, you know, improves survival compared to this other therapy and things like that. Then if the surrogate decision maker says, okay, let me go ahead and go with this option that is better medically, then the principle that's being reflected here is actually not the substituted judgment standard. The thing that's actually being reflected here is the best interest standard, right? So it's just something where, like, the easy way I try to explain this to people is, if for example 100 medical professionals were standing behind you and saying, oh, this is what I will go with, right? And you are making that decision as the surrogate decision maker for, like, again, like a comatose patient or whatever, then that is the best interest standard. Like, the thing that you feel like is best for the patient. And the thing is, this principle is also used by physicians, right? Let's say a trauma patient comes in. The patient has no family around. It's an emergent situation. The patient is about to die. The patient cannot communicate any decisions. If the physician does what, like, is medically indicated under those circumstances, that is an example of a best interests standard. Under those circumstances, the physician is acting as the surrogate decision maker. Again, very, very high yield to know this. And then, if a person has an advanced directive, right, and they designate someone as their healthcare power of attorney, then regardless of what happens down the line, that person that was designated as the healthcare power of attorney is the person that makes decisions for that patient, right? And again, you want to be able to understand like certain like higher terms, right? Like, oh, like what a living will is, right? Basically, a living will is like some document where patient has, you know, kind of given like advanced, has kind of given instructions like, okay, is there a specific kind of treatment I want or don't want if I have like a terminal illness? Are there certain things I would want for pain control? Those are all things that go into a living will, right? The healthcare power of attorney is like the person that in that living will, you say, okay, you know what? This is who I want to make decisions on my behalf if I'm altered and have no decision-making capacity. And then basically the advanced, in fact, let me maybe make this be a little more clear here so that it doesn't, I don't sound so vague here. The living will is where you make like specific instructions on, this is the kind of therapy I want, this is the kind of treatment I'm refusing, all that stuff. The healthcare power of attorney is the person you designate that, okay, this person is the one that's going to be making decisions for me if I have like a terminal illness or if I'm altered and I cannot make decisions for myself. And then if you essentially take that living will and combine that with the healthcare power of attorney like designation, that is something known as an advanced directive. Okay, that's something known as an advanced directive. But now let's assume a person doesn't have advanced directives on who should make a decision for them, right? And then as a physician, you have to like choose, okay, who makes decisions for this patient, right? You definitely want to know like the order. Like, oh, this is the person I should go with first. If that person is not available, this is who I should go with next, right? So the thing is, the person's spouse is the first person you always go with. If a spouse is not available, you go with like one of the adult children. So children over the age of 18, that's very high to know, right? If an adult child is not available, the next thing is the person's parent, if they're still alive. If a parent is not available, then you want to go with like an adult sibling. So again, a sibling that is more than 18 years of age. So again, those are all high yield things you'll want to keep in mind for exams. I'm certain if you've taken any MBME exams, you've probably encountered these like bizarre questions where you're like, this is not something I read in any book or something, okay? These are just things that people like often intuit on exams, but they're actually things that follow a very logical set of principles. So that logical set of principles is what I'm trying to convey as I go through these case scenarios. Okay, and then, I mean, obviously, you know this. This is not something that I need to talk much about, right? But you need to follow HIPAA laws, basically, right? You cannot, like, disclose a patient's medical information if, like, a family member is requesting it without the patient's say-so, without the patient's directive that, oh, yeah, you know what, you can go ahead and share this piece of information. But there is exceptions to that, right? And again, there are multiple exceptions, but the one rule, I try to remember like one thing that can help me control a ton of things, right? So the thing I tell people that I tutor is, essentially, the key exceptions to violating HIPAA is where you want to try to protect the patient or the general public from harm, or you have to obey the law, right? If you can keep those three things at the back of your mind and you're violating HIPAA, then that's not a problem on MBME exams. So key things, again, are you trying to keep the patient from harm, like killing themselves, or are you trying to protect the public from harm, so like a homicide kind of deal, or are you trying to obey the law, right? Those three things, in general, as long as those three things essentially, usually, for the most part, again, it goes on a case-by-case basis, but for the most part, those three things supersede having to obey HIPAA regulations on MBME exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a resident that's, you know, just finishing up his shift and then he's about to hand off to the next person that is coming on to take over like a team's list or whatever, right? This is essentially like it's like a patient handoff style of question. What are like some key things you want to keep in mind when selecting answers? The thing is, you'd want to pick an answer that relates to, you know, handoff happening like in person, right? You want to try to avoid like phone handoffs where possible, right? Again, the thing is, there are many different kinds of questions you can ask on these things. So I'm just trying to give you like the key high yield things you want to keep in mind in selecting answers, right? So you want to make sure that handoffs are done like face to face where possible, right? You want to provide like key pieces of information, right, in a standardized fashion. You want to do standardized handoffs on NBME exams, right? And the thing is, you may actually see answer choices that tell you that, oh, as you're conveying information, you want to use a lot of if-then statements, right? So, oh, if, for example, the patient's hemoglobin drops below 7, go ahead and give them a transfusion. Or if the patient becomes short of breath, get a chest x-ray to rule out like pneumonia or PE or whatever, right? So those are the things that make for a good patient handoff. Okay, you want to talk about like their key medications, key problems they have that may change while the person is off shift that you may need to act on, labs you may have to follow on. Again, these are things you want to keep in mind with patient handoffs. And then, I mean, if a medical error occurs, right, you obviously want to do this whole quality improvement business. But the first thing you want to do when an error occurs, right, is to study the error. You want to analyze the error. The big thing you want to keep in mind with, like, error analysis for NBMEs are these fishbone diagrams, right, like the so-called Ishikawa diagrams, where essentially, right, like if you look at, kind of look like a fish, like the head of the fish is where you define the error, and then you keep asking questions, what contributed to this error, and then you say, oh, this thing contributed, and then when you say, oh, okay, this is the thing that contributed, then you now work backwards again, okay, what contributed to this thing that contributed to the error, right? You essentially keep identifying factors, almost like the spines of a fish. That's why it's called a fishbone diagram. And then once you've identified an error, identified the causative factors and all that stuff, then if you want to like fix that error, right, that's what's known as quality improvement. The thing is, for quality improvement, the high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is like the high yield core principle you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams is something called the PDSA cycle, right? So like the PDSA cycle, the P just basically means like a plan, right? So you're like, okay, this is what we plan to, this is the intervention I want to implement in fixing this error, preventing this error. And then the do part is where you actually like, you know, do that thing. You may maybe use like a small subset of patients just to, it's almost like doing a scientific experiment. And then the S, right, is like, okay, like you study the results of what you just did. And then the A is like, okay, maybe it's like act, right, like you refine your protocol you made, or you refine the intervention, maybe like remove some things that you found to not be effective, add some things where you're like, okay, this may make things more effective, right? And that's how essentially, again, you fix the error, right? So like a PDSA cycle is like the backbone of quality improvement on NBME exams. There's a lot more stuff relating to QI, but I'll say that this is probably the big thing you want to keep in mind for the USMLEs. And then there are certain kinds of errors that people can make especially when they have to like make diagnoses on NBMEs, right? So like a clinician trying to make diagnoses, there are certain kinds of errors that your friends at the NBME love to go after with in like making like diagnostic decisions, right? So there are things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? So for example, what if they give you a question about a physician that, you know, has this physician has seen this, let's say a patient presents with like cough, dyspnea, and chest pain, right? And let's say this physician has seen that presentation before, and that person that presented before had a pneumonia, and then the physician just says, oh yeah, that means since you have the same presentation and this is a new patient, you must have pneumonia as well, even if the patient has a PE. What kind of error is that? That's an availability error, okay? It's a kind of reasoning error. It's an availability error. Now, what if you have a resident, you know, he comes on for his shift, and let's say a patient was admitted like 3 hours ago, and, or you know what, let me even make it a little more vague, because this is what the NBME will want, probably want to do to you on a test. What if they give you a question about a patient, you know, this patient presents with like a certain set of symptoms that they've presented with similarly in the past at a different hospitalization. And let's say at that different hospitalization, certain diagnoses have been made. Let's say, oh, this patient has, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, right? And then the patient comes in this time, similar presentation, and you just immediately say, oh yeah, this patient has PNH, and you don't think about like a differential or anything like that. What kind of bias, what kind of error is that called? That's an anchoring error. That's an anchoring bias, okay? A-N-C-H-O-R-I-N-G, okay? That shows up very commonly on MBME exams. And then, what if you get a question about like a resident, you know, he comes on for his shift and, you know, he has this patient that was maybe like the attending before the attending left, the attending like quickly admitted a patient and then handed that patient off to the resident. And then the resident just essentially goes and like everything the attending told the resident, he blindly believes everything the attending mentioned. Like he doesn't even think like, oh, you know what may be another thing that may be contributing to this patient's presentation sort of deal. That kind of bias is called like the blind obedience. It's kind of like obvious from the term. It's called the blind obedience bias. Where it's essentially like if someone that is more senior to you has told you something, you believe it hook, line, and sinker without like thinking independently for yourself as a clinician. And then what if you get a question about a patient where this patient, again, like a resident or a clinician, patient presents cough, fever, chest pain, and you see like a chest x-ray shows consolidation and boom, you're like, it's pneumonia, nothing else. And you don't consider like other things that may be on the differential that may present in a similar way. That's something called like a premature closure bias. You essentially just like you consider one thing and then you don't consider other things, right? That is a recipe for disaster. I'm just saying this as a clinical peril, but that's actually a recipe for disaster as a clinician, right? You may get into trouble in the future doing that. There may be patients that may present in a common way, but for an uncommon problem, right? Premature closure gets you into those kinds of problems. So I will encourage you, yes, you know what the patient is having, right? Like, oh, this patient likely has this, but try to consider other things that may be on your differential. Okay, because you may not be able to stand up in court if you get into those kinds of troubles. Okay, now, what if you get a question about, in fact, this is where, this is one area the MBME shines. They use like certain like, almost like analytic tools, like words that relate to certain analytic tools that people have never heard of before, and then they freak out, right, when they see these things on exams. Really, all you need to do is to be able to recognize these terms on an MBME, right? So, let's say, for example, they give you a question about a patient that, you know, is undergoing, like, intimate partner violence at home, and then they ask, like, oh, which of the following screening methods may be employed in detecting intimate partner violence in this patient? Right. The thing is, there are three words you want to remember. One word is HITS, okay? The other word is HARK, so like H-A-R-K. And then the third word is STAT, right? These are the three things you want to keep in mind. So HITS, STAT, and HARK, right? The HITS just means, does your partner hurt you? That's the H. Does your partner insult you? That's the I. Does your partner ever like threaten you? That's the T. Does your partner ever scream at you, right? That's the S, right? And then the HARK is like, oh, like has your partner like humiliated you at any point? Or are you afraid of your partner? Has this partner ever tried to like rape you? Has this partner ever like kicked you, right? That's again, kind of like just a mnemonic. And then like the STAT just means like, have you been slapped? Have you been threatened? Have you been like thrown around from one end of a room to another by your partner? Those are all things you can use to screen for intimate partner violence. And then, what if a patient, let's see, what if a patient, you're trying to screen this patient for like alcohol abuse, right? What kind of tools, what tools would you want to use to screen those patients on MBMEs? So the thing is, there's two of those things, right? But one is generally better than the other, right? So everyone knows the CAGE questionnaire. Have you tried to cut down? Eye-opener. Do you feel guilty? Do you feel annoyed when people ask you about your drinking? That's the CAGE questionnaire. But the thing is, there is also something called the Audit C questionnaire that you can use. The thing is, if you see audit C and you see cage as answer choices on an MBME, go with audit C. Audit C is better. It has been better validated and has been shown to be very effective in screening people for the use and abuse of alcohol. And I mean, obviously, right, if a person is like an alcohol abuser, there are certain high yield associations, right, you want to keep in mind on MBMEs, right? Like they may have like a megaloblastic anemia, so the MCV may be high. They'll have like elevated GGT. That's a very high yield thing to keep in mind on exams. AST, ALT ratio, right, maybe more than like 2:1, right? And the thing is, like, what makes you classify a person as having like drinking too much, right? Basically, if you're a lady or if you're more than 65 years old, so like male, female, more than 65 years old, if you consume more than like 7 drinks in a week, right? Or let's say like in one sitting, you consume more than 3 drinks, those people are at high risk of being like drinkers, like impaired. Like, I think the term is like, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's called like at-risk drinking. An at-risk drinker, again, more than 65, male or female or any female of any sort, right? If you drink more than 7, if you have more than 7 drinks in a week or more than 3 drinks in one sitting, that's at-risk drinking. For a guy, you essentially double that number, right? Like more than 14 drinks in a week or more than 4 drinks in one sitting, okay? So audit C is better than cage. Okay, again, very high yield to know that. And then the thing is, remember, right, the different signs and symptoms of like alcohol withdrawal. Those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And the thing is, like the alcoholic hallucinosis or the delirium tremens. Obviously, you want to give those people benzos, right, under those circumstances. And the thing is, in general, before you employ the cage questionnaire or the audit C questionnaire with people, you want to quantify how much they drink. If a person does not drink extensively, then it makes no sense to do the cage questionnaire or the audit C questionnaire on those people. Okay, so you may get a question about a person that drinks, and then the next best step in management may actually be to quantify their drinking as against employing the cage questionnaire or the audit C questionnaire. The cage audit C questionnaires are things you use after you know how much those people actually drink. Again, you may say, Divine, these things are like, come on, these things are, who cares? I promise you, these things are very, very high yield to know for MBME, to know for MBME exams. Okay, now, right, also remember, right, if a person is like an alcoholic, they come into the ED, right, you want to give them thiamine first before glucose and all that stuff, right, so that you don't precipitate like Wernicke Korsakoff syndrome. Now, one high yield thing that people often mess up on exams is if a person is withdrawing from alcohol, like alcohol, or they are delirious because they are withdrawing from alcohol, do not give those people anti-dopaminergic agents, right? You don't want to give them like an antipsychotic. Antipsychotics actually increase the risk of seizure when you give it to people that are withdrawing from alcohol. In general, if a person is delirious, you can give an antipsychotic, but delirium from alcohol withdrawal is treated with benzodiazepines, not antipsychotics. That's a very subtle detail that many people mess up, but it's something you definitely want to know for your exams. Okay, and I mean in general, right, if you're worried about alcohol withdrawal, you treat based on symptoms, right? You don't just empirically, boom, start a person on like alcohol withdrawal or regimens, right? The presence of a symptom is what like should trigger you to start treating. And then if a person, right, is addicted to opioids, right, things you may want to, I should probably drink some water. Things you may want to do to help those people, right? You want to give them like buprenorphine, or you can give them like Suboxone. That's like the combination of like buprenorphine and naloxone, right? Those are all things you can use to help people with opioid dependence, right? And then if a person is going through opioid withdrawal on your MBMEs, you want to go ahead and go with clonidine as your treatment. I've described the mechanism and the pathophysiology behind that in like certain old podcasts that I have made. So you can go and listen to those if you're in any way interested, or you can email me if you have any questions. And then what if you What if you get a question about a patient that is trying to quit smoking? What are certain things you can consider as treatment on an MBME exam, right? So actually, one thing you can consider as treatment is like nicotine replacement therapy, okay? Nicotine, so like nicotine gums, lozenges, and all that stuff, nicotine patches. Another thing you may actually want to consider on your exam is also like bupropion, right? Especially if the person has like comorbid depression. So like bupropion, remember it's an NDRI, right? It's a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor that can actually also help with smoking cessation. And then another thing you could also consider is varenicline, okay? Varenicline works on our nicotine receptors. If I'm not mistaken, I believe it's a partial nicotine receptor agonist. It can actually help with smoking cessation. And the thing is, of all these three, the one that is the most effective is varenicline. After varenicline, the next most effective is bupropion. After bupropion, the one that's more next is like the least effective of all is nicotine replacement, but it works. Okay, it's just varenicline works a lot better. And in general, if you if you combine instead of using just one thing, if you say like, oh, nicotine replacement and bupropion, those work more than using like one of those things alone. And I'll just tell you this, if you get an MBME question and you see smoking cessation as an answer, that is almost always the correct thing to do, right? And you may see like some novel MBME questions about like e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes are never the right answer, okay? You should never choose them to help with smoking cessation on an MBME exam. Never, ever choose e-cigarettes as smoking cessation aids on MBME exams. Okay, so, let's see. I know I've kind of talked about this in a prior podcast, but let me just throw that in here because it's something I feel like I can talk about fairly quickly again. Again, repetition always helps, right? So what is the screening guideline for a AAA? Well, I hope you're telling me that you can do like an abdominal ultrasound for people between the ages of like 65 to 75, right? If they've ever smoked, right? And the thing is, one weird one, although it would kind of mean if the MBME does this to you, but if a person has actually never smoked, they can actually still be eligible for AAA screening if they have like a family history, right? They have like a family member that has a AAA. You can also screen them with a one-time ultrasound between the ages of 65 to 75. And remember that this only applies to men. You do not screen women for AAAs. And then for osteoporosis, right, you want to screen people like women. Men are not screened for osteoporosis. You want to screen like women, women that are more than 65 years old, right? You want to screen them. If the T-score is less than negative 2.5, you go ahead and place them on a bisphosphonate, right? And then remember that if a person is less than 65 and they have like certain like triggering conditions, so let's say they've been on steroids for a long period of time, or they have like anorexia nervosa, right? Those kinds of people should be screened for osteoporosis, even if they are less than 65 years of age. This is probably more for step three, but if a person has a FRAX score, it's like a score that estimates your risk of fracture within the next 10 years. If your FRAX score is more than like 9.3%, those people are also eligible for osteoporosis screening, again, even if they are less than the age of 65. And then the HPV guidelines, right? Obviously, for HPV, you want to go ahead and screen. Let me just make it easy, right? From the age of 21 to 30, right, you do EQ 3 years. Or if you want to, again, even make your life even easier, you can say from the age of 21 to 65, you screen every 3 years, okay? But starting at age 30, you can do it every 5 years. And this is actually what is preferred. You can essentially like add HPV co-testing. You do that every 5 years. But if a person has like an immunodeficiency disease, so let's say they have HIV, for example, you want to go ahead and screen them every year for with a pap smear. And then colon cancer, right? Classically, you know, hit the age of 50, you start screening. And I mean, there are many, and you do it every 10 years, right? Although the thing is, it's not always, let me go ahead and see this. It's not always every 10 years, right? So there are different means, right? So you can do like an annual FOBT, like a fecal occult or blood test to screen for colon cancer. You can do something called the FIT test, like it's like an immunochemical test. They call it like the fecal immunochemical test. You can also do that every year. Another thing you can do is you can actually do like a colonoscopy every 10 years, right? That one everyone knows. And then you can actually do FlexSig, right? So like a flexible sigmoidoscopy, like every 5 years. Or if you're combining like the FlexSig with the FIT tests that I mentioned earlier, you can actually do that every 10 years, like FlexSig plus like an annual FIT. Like you're doing the FIT test every year, right? If you're doing the FIT test every year, then you can actually do the FlexSig every 10 years. I'll be shocked if the NBME throws that on an exam, but again, you never know. So those are kind of like the big ones. I mean, like these days, some people say, you know what, you can do CT colonography like every 5 years, but that's not one I would expect for people to see on an NBME exam. And remember, right, if a family member has like colon cancer at the age of 53, right, like a first degree relative, then you start screening like 10 years earlier, right? Like, so you start screening at like the age of 43. Basically, this is high yield to know. So say, for example, you get a question. I just sort of realized my mistake now. So let's say you get a question about a patient that, you know, they have a first degree relative, had colon cancer at 53. Here's the thing. They then ask you, when should you start screening like family members for colon cancer, right? They will give you like the age of 40 as an answer. They'll give you the age of 43 as an answer. The thing is, you actually want to start screening at the age of 40, okay? So if a person has a family member history of colon cancer, you want to start screening 10 years earlier or at the age of 40, whichever comes first. So under these circumstances, yeah, family member 53 with colon cancer, but if you backtrack 10 years, that's 43, but 40 years comes before that. So you go with that 40-year screening option. Again, these are all high-yield things. Again, in the heat of an exam, these are things that are very simple that you can get correct if you know the information again. Okay, so again, I know it's annoying to think about these things to study for exams, but again, I promise you, these are things you absolutely positively want to know for tests, right? And then lung cancer, right? If a person has like a 30-pack-year smoking history and let's assume even if a person has quit, as long as they quit like less than 15 years ago, you do like a low-dose CT scan every year, right? Prostate cancer is kind of something you kind of need to discuss between the physician and the patient. The only like absolute recommendation, like, oh, everyone seems to agree on for prostate cancer, is when you hit the age of 70, screening for prostate cancer is not recommended past the age of 70. And then one other weird thing with these pap smears, right? So if, for example, a lady has had like a hysterectomy, right? For, let's say she had a hysterectomy for like a leiomyoma or something for a benign reason, then you don't need to do pap smears anymore. Like if you've done like a hysterectomy, remove the cervix and all that stuff for a benign reason, no need to do a pap smear anymore. But if a person had a hysterectomy for like endometrial hyperplasia, endometrial cancer or whatever, you still need to do pap smears of the vaginal cuff. That's a very high yield thing you want to remember for the USMLE exams. And then for breast cancer, right, like USPSTFCS, start at 50 till you get to the age of 74, do it every 2 years. American Cancer Society says start at 40, do it every year, right? So it kind of varies, but in general, if a woman is more than 40 years old, you can screen her for breast cancer on the NBME exams. And then if a person is like sexually active and they have an STI, you want to go ahead and screen them for STIs, right? You want to go ahead and screen them for like chlamydia, for gonorrhea, for HIV, the works. But if a person is less than 21, you do not do a pap smear on those people, okay? That's very important to keep in mind on NBME exams. And then like some key weird stuff with vaccines, right? So if you're a healthcare worker, you should get the Hep B vaccine, right? I'm not going to tell you every single vaccine. I'm just going to tell you the ones that are more commonly tested on exams. The influenza vaccine, right? It's something that you want to do like every year, right? In the fall, right? So if a person comes in April on an NBME exam, the right answer would not be to vaccinate them against influenza, right? Tdap, right? Like the tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis vaccine, right? So most people should get like one Tdap dose, and then every year they should get the TD booster every 10 years, okay? But there is a weird exception to that. If a woman is pregnant and she's between like 27 to 36 weeks, for every pregnancy, she actually needs like a full Tdap between 27 and 36 weeks for every pregnancy that she has, right? And again, the varicella vaccine, right? You don't want to give it to a kid that's less than 1 year old. That's kind of high yield to know. HPV, again, if it's a woman, you can start as early as age 9. Usually on NBMEs, they go at age 11, but you can do anywhere from age 9 to 26 for a woman. For a guy, you start at 11, right? You can do it from like age 11 to like 21. But if you have a case of like men that have sex with other men, you can actually do HPV vaccination up until the age of 26, okay? That's something that's kind of high yield to know. And then if they give you a question about like a military recruit or a college student, like a person like living in a dormitory, going to college, whatever, you want to go ahead and give those people the meningococcal vaccine, right? You want to go ahead and give them the meningococcal vaccine. And then remember, right, if a person has like, if their spleen is gone for some reason, you want to vaccinate them against encapsulated organisms, right? So like strep pneumo, H flu, Neisseria meningitidis, sort of deal. Or if a person is going to be placed on eculizumab, right? Remember, eculizumab is a monoclonal antibody against the C5. So it inhibits a terminal complement component. Remember that under normal circumstances, people that have terminal complement component deficiencies, they have a very high risk of recurring Neisseria infections, right? So if a person has PNH, you're putting them on eculizumab. Before you start them on eculizumab, you want to vaccinate them against the Neisseria meningitis. And one weird thing they may throw on a test is they may say, oh, this person has an egg allergy. Should I give them the influenza vaccine? Yes, you should. You should give them the influenza vaccine. If a person has an egg allergy, that is not a contraindication to getting the influenza vaccine. And again, special populations like kids less than a year old, pregnant women, you do not want to give them any kind of live vaccine, right? So what are like the classic live vaccines that they sort of shuffle around on NBMEs, right? So things like, I don't know, like varicella, for example, right? The MMR vaccine, the yellow fever vaccine. The herpes zoster vaccine as well is something you don't want to give on an NBME to, again, like a pregnant woman. And then like the influenza vaccine, like the intranasal one, that's also a live attenuated vaccine. You don't want to give it to a pregnant woman on NBMEs. And then the pneumococcal vaccine guidelines, unfortunately, are things you want to keep in mind for your NBMEs, right? So there are certain key constructs that they love to throw on exams with these pneumococcal vaccines, right? So if, for example, a person is more than 65 years old, they do need the pneumococcal vaccine, right? Like a normal person more than 65, they need the pneumococcal vaccine. In fact, the way I try to, when I'm tutoring people and I tell them how to remember these pneumococcal vaccines, remember it as, is this person older than 65 or is this person less than 65? Those are like the two big groups of people. In general, if you're older than 65, you should get the pneumococcal vaccine. And then there's this source of confusion for many people, like, oh, Divine, which one do I give first? Do I give the PCV13 or the PPSV23 or whatever? Here's the deal, okay? Remember, the lower number should come first. So you give the PCV13 first. And then like 1 year after you give PCV13, you then slot in the PPSV23, okay? The thing is, in fact, I'll talk about this at the end so that I don't jumble things up for people. So that's the over 65 case. PCV13 first. 1 year later, PPSV23. End of story. Okay? Now, if a person is less than 65, they are not always eligible for the pneumococcal vaccine, but they may be eligible for the pneumococcal vaccine, right? So, for example, if a person has like sickle cell disease, or a person has like thalassemia, or a person has no spleen, or a person has like something that could make them immunocompromised, right? So let's say they have like HIV, or they have like chronic kidney disease, or they have like, they're like on immunosuppressants because they've gotten like some kind of transplant, or a person has like an immunodeficiency disorder, or the person has like a hematologic malignancy, Hodgkin's lymphoma, leukemia, lymphoma, stuff like that. Or a person has like nephrotic syndrome. Remember, nephrotic syndrome actually makes people, it's like a functional cause of immunodeficiency. Or if a person has like, these are like super weird, but they occasionally pop up on tests. If a person has like a CSF leak, or they have like a cochlear implant, those people do need pneumococcal vaccination if they are less than 6, even if they are less than 65, right? So, and those people, again, same thing. They need PCV13 and they need PPSV23, okay? That's, again, another big group you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, the third major group you want to keep at the back of your mind, especially for the people that are less than 65, is if a person has like chronic disease. And again, kind of think of the major organs: heart, lung, liver, right? Heart, lung, and liver. If a person has chronic disease in any of those organs, or they have like diabetes, or they're alcoholics, or they smoke a ton, right? Those people also need pneumococcal vaccination. But here is one weird exception. Again, I'll repeat it again. If a person has like chronic disease of like the heart, the lungs, the liver, okay, or they smoke, or they drink a ton, or they have diabetes, they do need pneumococcal vaccination. But the only one you give those people is PPSV23. You do not give them PCV13. And then this is something that is more for step three, but there are certain people that after they get one dose of PPSV23, they get another dose of PPSV23, like 5 years after the first PPSV23 dose. The general principle you want to remember here is, if a person got their original PPSV23 before the age of 65, then they should get another one 5 years later, okay? That's probably the only thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with exams. And then, again, you want to kind of remember, again, this is like one of those weird things where you either know it or you don't, but you want to kind of remember, right, like certain vaccines, right? So I've talked about like the high-yield live attenuated vaccines, like the intranasal influenza, or like MMR, or like yellow fever, or like varicella. Certain vaccines are inactivated, right? So like your Tdap vaccine is inactivated. The injectable influenza vaccine is inactivated, right? The pneumococcal, HPV vaccine, meningococcal vaccine, Hep A, Hep B vaccines, those are all inactivated vaccines, right? So those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. You want to know like, oh, is it live attenuated? Is it inactivated? Those are things that they occasionally throw on exams. And then, I think I should probably go ahead and stop here. This has gone on now for like an hour plus. But again, I promise you, this podcast is floridly high yield for step 2 CK and for step 3. In fact, if you're a medicine resident studying for like your in-training exam, this is a floridly high yield podcast. You're going to see things based on what I said tested on those exams. So I do hope you get something from this. As I say at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step 1, 2CK, 2CS, step 3, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams, the internal medicine in-training exam, the internal medicine board exam. I offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you have like a college buddy that needs tutoring for like physics, gen chem, o-chem, biochem, physiology, histology, I'd offer tutoring for all those things, right? And then if you're like a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying for med school, like an AMCASAP, I'd offer like one-on-one advising, consulting for those things, like personal statement writing, application prep, stuff like that, mock interviews, things like that. Again, I have a lot of experience in these areas, so reach out to me. Either send me an email, Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com, or you can send me, or you can reach out to me through the website. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you in the next episode. Thank you. And actually, one thing I want to say before I forget. So a lot of people have requested that I put these podcasts on like a podcast app that will make it easy to listen to. I'm working on that. I've tried multiple times in the past and failed, basically. Not getting something right doesn't mean I probably shouldn't have used the term failed. Not getting something right doesn't mean you failed, okay? So I haven't gotten it right before, but I'm gonna try again. And there is someone that is helping me right now that will probably be able to make that happen. So it will likely get on a podcast website sometime in the very near, on a podcast app sometime in the very near future. So kind of watch out for that. But in the meantime, the thing you can do is you can subscribe to my podcast, so that whenever I make a new post on like a new podcast or something and I post it on the website, you get an email or something. Okay, so you can subscribe to my WordPress, because my website is a WordPress based website. Okay, so I think that's all for now. Thank you for listening. God bless you. I'll see you next time. Thank you.